Good to see everybody here this morning. Hope you've had a good week. Been a full week. I know just from looking at all the bright and smiling faces of our young people that they are excited about going back to school and eagerly anticipating it. Or maybe I'm misreading their expression a little bit. I know we've got some that are about to head off to college as well, and we want to remember them in our prayers. Also good to see Kim and Peggy both back today. I know Kim is delighted to feel good enough to get out and do anything right now. Please continue to remember him as he approaches another surgery, and wonderful to see Peggy. And we know that her heart pacemaker has worked very well because Kim helped her to try it out right afterward with all of his illnesses. But we're delighted to see them here and delighted to see everybody. We have visitors we have the Allisons here as well. It's good to see Chad and Lana and all the rest of you that are visiting today. It's especially good because I think this is our last get out of town day before school. You can see we are missing quite a few, and we want to remember them in our prayers as they travel. If you have your Bibles and would like to turn over, we're going to be in Revelation, the second and third chapter. And I want to look at the churches there, and maybe in a different way than we have done that before, but to really kind of break it up in the pattern that Christ broke it up in as far as the way he talked to the churches. And as you go through Revelation, the second and third chapter, you'll notice, first of all, he is writing to the seven churches in Asia, and that he talks to each one of them, but in a very similar pattern. And it's split up in this way. First of all, he addresses each one of the churches, tells who he's talking to and the message that he's bringing. Then he says he knows what's going on. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But he does that to each one of the congregations and lets them know that he's aware of their, not only their difficulties, but also of their sin. Then he tells them of their problems that they're going through. Some of the problems, nearly all of the problems we're going to look at, are of a sinful nature, either from the church or from the ones that they're experiencing from other people. And then he talks about the solution to the problem. And then at the very end, he talks about the reward for those who will abide by his solution. And so let's just go ahead and look at that, the addresses to each one of them we'll start with. But the church at Ephesus is found in the first seven verses of chapter 2. Then in verses 8 through 11, we read of the church at Smyrna. Then we read of the church of Pergamum in verses 12 through 17 of chapter 2. And then Thyatira in verses 18 through the end of chapter 2. And then we have three churches in Revelation chapter 3, verses 1 through 6, talks about Sardis, verses 7 through 13 about Philadelphia, and verses 14 through 22 of chapter 3 talks about Laodicea. But let me just read the addresses in order. In chapter 1, verse 1, to the angel of the church in Ephesus write, these are the words of him who holds the seven stars in his right hand and walks among the seven golden lampstands. When he talks to the church at Smyrna in verse 8, to the angel or messenger, version might read, to the angel in the church of Smyrna write, these are the words of him who is the first and the last, who died and came to life again. In verse 12, to the angel of the church of Pergamum, write, these are the words of him who has the sharp, double-edged sword. And then in verse 18, to the angel of the church in Thyatira, write, these are the words of the Son of God, whose eyes are like a blazing fire and whose feet are like burnished bronze. And so now we know the one that is writing to these churches is, in fact, the Son of God, and he describes himself in different ways as he goes through, but very clear when he writes to the church of Thyatira exactly who he is. He's the Son of God. In chapter 3 and verse 1, to the angel of the church in Sardis write, these are the words of him who holds the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. In verse 7, to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, these are the words of him who is holy and true, who holds the key of David. What he opens, no one can shut, and what he shuts, no one can open. And now we have the revelation here that Christ is the final word on everything. And we know this is true because God gave him that authority. But what he opens, no one can shut, and what he shuts, no one can open. He is the final word. Everything he says is the final say in this matter. In verse 14, to the church at Laodicea write, "These are the words of the Amen, the faithful and true witness, the ruler of God's creation." And so there we have the introductions. We have the churches that he's addressing, these seven churches in Asia. And we're going to read a little bit something about each one of them. And it's this next part that I really want you to think about as we look this morning. And that is the fact that Jesus knows everything. Look at chapter 2 and verse 2. He's still writing to Ephesus here. He says, "I know your deeds." I don't know about you, but that gets my attention. He knows what you're doing. But then he says this, "your hard work and your perseverance. I know that you cannot tolerate wicked men, that you have tested those who claim to be apostles, but are not, and have found them false. You have persevered and have endured hardships for my name and have not grown weary." Jesus knows all of this. To Smyrna in verse 9, he says, "I know your afflictions and your poverty, yet you're rich. I know the slander of those who are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan." I want to point out at this stage that Smyrna and Philadelphia are the only two churches that Jesus addresses where he does not address their sin. They don't have a big crisis that they need to address as far as their sinful behavior. But notice the commonality between these two, Smyrna and Philadelphia, who they're combating. They're combating the Jews. We have a perverse situation in the world today, especially among the denominational world, where somehow the Jews are lifted up as if they are in good standing with God. But I want you to notice as he talks to Smyrna that he says they are not Jews, they are a synagogue of Satan. When you read the book of Romans, he's very clear. Not everyone who is descendant of Abraham is a child of Abraham. He makes a difference between the physical and the spiritual, and he's making a very big difference here. The Jews who were acceptable first, who are now rejecting Christ and who have had an opportunity to accept Christ but have not, are referred to as a synagogue, not of God, but they are referred to as a synagogue of Satan. And this is important because if we reject this, we reject Christ, the one who what he opens is opened and what he shuts is shuts and which cannot be changed. Smyrna's difficulty doesn't come because of their own sin, but because of the sin of those who have rejected Christ. Pergamum, verse 13, continuing with this, "I know where you live, where Satan has his throne." For the second time, he points out that Satan is the problem. "Yet you remain true to my name. You did not renounce your faith in me, even in the days of Antipas, my faithful witness, who was put to death in your city where Satan lives." This is a very wicked city, Pergamum. So wicked, in fact, that Satan is acknowledged as having the control of this city. We live in an era now where we kind of make light of Satan and his power. We act as if he is some sort of a comical figure or a charming figure. He is not. He is a danger. He is an enemy of the cross, and he is an enemy of every Christian. And he is a true and present danger. And he's talking to the church at Pergamum, and he says, "I know where you live. I know the difficulty that you have with Satan." In Thyatira, to Thyatira in verse 19, he says this, "I know your deeds, your love, your faith, your service, and your perseverance, and that you are now doing more than you did at first." Isn't this a comfort for God, for Christ, to know what we're doing? He knows everything about us. Again, the good and the bad. To Sardis in chapter 3, the middle part of verse 1, he says, "I know your deeds." And then he reveals they have a reputation of being alive and says, but they are dead. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. To Philadelphia, he says the same thing. I know your deeds. As a matter of fact, over and over and over as he talks to the churches, he says, I know your deeds. That's another way of saying, I know what you're doing. I know your deeds, he says to the Philadelphian church. See, I've placed before you an open door that no one can shut. I know that you have little strength, yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. I will make those who are a synagogue of Satan, who claim to be Jews, though they are not, but are liars, I will make them come and fall down at your feet and acknowledge that I have loved you. And so again, Philadelphia does not have sinful problems within the church, but they do have problems from those who are sinning on the outside that they're dealing with. And then finally, Laodicea in verse 15, I know your deeds. And then he says that you are neither cold nor hot. I wish you were one or the other. Again and again, I know your deeds. Now, let me ask you this. How does that make you feel? Jesus knows what's going on with his church in Happy, Texas. He knows what we're doing. He knows who's here today. He knows who wants to be here today but isn't. And he knows those who are here today but don't particularly want to be here today. He knows those who are excusing themselves from the worship and those who have a reason to be gone from the worship. He knows what you went through this week. He knows your health problems. He knows the things that you're struggling with your family. He knows all of the good things that you have done in your perseverance. He knows what's going on with your business, with your farms and your ranches. He knows exactly what's happening to you. He even knows I got bit by a brown recluse this last week. You ever been bit by a brown recluse? I wouldn't recommend it. But you know what? I have a brother-in-law who had something that was called a brown recluse first aid kit. Which is a marvelous thing to think about. It makes me wonder if God didn't answer the prayer for help this week sometime many years earlier when he went out and bought that brown recluse kit. But he knows what's going on. He knows that Bo started school this last week, and he knows those of you who are starting school this week. He knows those of you who have been mowing lawns for the widows, and he knows why you've been doing it. He knows about our work with the children's homes. He knows what we've brought in, and he knows why we've brought it in. He knows of our work with the churches in Africa, and he knows about each one there and the struggles that they're going through. He knows about our work with trying to spread the word of God and to encourage others. He knows everything about you. He knows about your secret sins. He knows about the things that you are trying to lift up in the eyes of men yet are really shameful when it comes down to it. He knows about your humility and the fact that when you are doing something for God, that sometimes you don't always recognize it as great as it is because you are humble in your heart. He knows those of you who are Christians. He knows those of you who are not Christians. He knows those of you who are thinking about becoming a Christian. And he knows those of you who have closed your heart to it. He knows everything about us. He knows those of us who are feeling sorry for ourselves for things that we shouldn't feel sorry for in the greatest nation on the face of the earth right now. He knows the things that we are dealing with that we just deal with because we do it, even though many others would crumble under it. He knows. When he says, I know your deeds, he is not just talking. He's talking about that intimate understanding and relationship that he has with each one of us. And he knows. And that will either leave us, I believe, with a great comfort in knowing about those struggles and knowing that he's helping us, or it will leave us with a deep sense of unease knowing that he knows what we're doing and maybe we shouldn't be doing it. He knows. How does that leave you feeling? Because as he talked to each one of these churches, in part when he said, I know your deeds, some of them he was congratulating and some of them he was condemning. And it depends on the state of our life right now as to which he is doing for us and to which he is doing for the church here in Happy. And then he goes to the problems, and the problems are varied. But let's start with Ephesus in chapter 2 and verse 4. After he's told Ephesus of all the good things that they're doing, and Ephesus probably has the longest list of commendable deeds, he says, "Yet I hold this against you, you have forsaken your first love." That always makes me think, because there are times where I'm convinced that we are doing well in so many areas, but it's not our first love. Jesus is not the most important in our life. God is not the most important in our life. There's something else. There's another that is there. There is an idol between us and God and Christ, whatever that idol may be. That idol may be something that you enjoy. That may be that idol something that's very difficult that you don't enjoy, but it swallows the bulk of your heart and your time. And so to Ephesus, who is doing so well in so many things, Jesus says, "I hold this against you. You have forsaken your first love." At Smyrna, while they have no problems of their own, they do have this problem. "I know of the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are of the synagogue of Satan." Think about that in our modern religious world, where everybody is just okay, except for those who don't think everybody is just okay. Think about the Christians that are people who identify themselves as Christians who maybe are putting stumbling blocks in your path. Because that happens. It was happening here among those who had been God's chosen people, and yet who had rejected his only begotten Son. And so while Smyrna was not dealing with their own sin, they were certainly dealing with the struggles that came from the sins of others. And then in verse 14, Pergamum. After commending Pergamum for dealing very well with the area they were in, he said this: "Nevertheless, I have a few things against you. You have people there who hold to the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to entice the Israelites to sin by eating food sacrificed to idol and committing sexual immorality. Likewise, you have those who hold to the teaching of the Nicolaitans." Think about this for a moment. We look at our own lives and say, "Well, I don't have any trouble with being led astray like Balaam was teaching Balak to do to the Israelites. I don't worship in a way that includes sexual immorality. I don't hold to the teachings of the Nicolaitans, which secular history tells us was a teaching that taught them that sexual immorality was okay, that everything of a physical nature was okay. It was essentially grace was a license to sin." And we might think we don't have trouble with that, but let me ask you this. What did you watch this last week? What did you look at online on your computers? What types of books did you read? What types of thoughts did you think as you viewed other people? Do you have some of the struggles that Pergamum had? Could God say to you, or Christ say to you, "You're doing so well in this and this and this area, nevertheless, you've really got to work on this or you'll be lost for all eternity"? I think we all find ourselves in that position from time to time. To Thyatira in verse 20, again, after commending them for their faith and their perseverance, he says, "Nevertheless, I have this against you. You tolerate that woman Jezebel." Now, Jezebel apparently was a real woman that was a false teacher in the church of Thyatira. I don't know if her real name was Jezebel or if he was just going back and calling her a Jezebel, like Queen Jezebel, who is married to Ahab, who was so wicked, or what the circumstance was. All I know was they had a woman here who was wicked that the church was embracing. She was claiming that she spoke from God, and she had a message that they liked. And the message, again, was one of sexual immorality, and she was leading the church into that. Do you think that we're the only era that's ever had problems with that? Or do you think they were the era that had problems with that, and since we don't have the specific problems they do, that we're okay? Sometimes that woman Jezebel sits on our in our living room on a nice stand that has great color and great resolution that we can just switch to all sorts of different things to watch what Jezebel is doing. Maybe it's a little computer that you have in front of you that you can go from Jezebel to Jezebel to Jezebel with. I don't know what it is in your life, but I do want to assure you that we still struggle with the struggles that they did. And Jesus said, I have this against you. Let me ask you this on the day of judgment. If he says you were faithful and persevered in most things, and yet I have this against you, do you think that we have a chance for eternal salvation? Do you think that we need to take care of the Jezebels in our life? To Sardis, he says this. After saying, I know your deeds, he said, you have a reputation for being alive, but you're dead. You look good to others. They look like a Christian on the outside. They look like they were going to heaven from all external appearances. But Christ, who looks at the heart, looked at their heart and said, essentially, in effect, you are spiritually lost. You are in a position that's going to take you to hell. He said, I know you have the appearance of being alive, but he said, you are dead. There was no question as to where their eternal resting place would be if they didn't take care of something. And so he continues by saying, wake up, strengthen what remains and is about to die, for I have not found your deeds complete. I wonder how often Christ could look at our individual lives, my individual life, and say, I haven't found your deeds complete. To Philadelphia again, he goes over the struggles that they're having with other congregations. And then to Laodicea, he says this. And this is the part we'll close with this morning. He says in verse 15, I know your deeds, that you are neither hot nor cold. I wish you were one or the other. Why would Christ wish that we wouldn't do good if we're doing bad too? Have you ever wondered about that? And the answer is this. He mentions the punishment. Because you're lukewarm, neither hot nor cold, I'm about to spit you out of my mouth. But the problem is this. When we're lukewarm, we are so much more likely to mislead people. When people know that we call ourselves Christians, but we live like this, they might be tempted to think that that's how Christians can live. Or they might look at our lives and say, well, they're hypocrites, and I don't want anything to do with hypocrisy. But it can keep people away from God. The beauty of the reading of the churches in Revelation, and we'll conclude with it tonight, is this. Christ sees us all. He sees us as individuals, and he sees us as churches. He knows what's going on with us. He feels for our struggles, and he will help us with our struggles. But he will not tolerate sin. And so if we have that in our lives, we need to change. And that, I believe, is at least the bulk of the message that I want to leave with you this morning. I think the focus of what we've looked at this morning. We do want to offer the invitation. It may be that somebody's ready to become a Christian today. We would love to help you with that. Maybe you need the prayers of the congregation. If we can help you in any way, won't you come while we stand and sing?